This is The Friday Show on KLCC. I'm Jason Brown in for Rachel McDonald. Dr. Patrick Lubke, Lane County Senior Public Health Officer, is again with us this week to answer some questions as we navigate this new transitional period between the pandemic and normal life. Dr. Lubke, good afternoon, and thanks so much for being with us today.
Good afternoon to you, and thank you as well.
So yesterday, the CDC offered updated guidance on masks, stating that fully vaccinated people no longer need to wear them, both indoors and outdoors. And shortly after that announcement, Oregon Governor Kate Brown delivered a message by video stating that fully vaccinated Oregonians no longer need to wear masks or be socially distant. Dr. Lubke, did this announcement come to you as a surprise, and what's your take on this new guidance?
Well, it was precipitous, I will say that. We have for some time been planning for a decrease in some of these what we call NPI, non-pharmaceutical interventions, the physical distancing and the masks. But it came more quickly than I think many of us in the local health department space would have expected. So long story, yes, a bit of a surprise in terms of how quickly it occurred.
So I think a lot of people will have a lot of questions about this, and one of them is, how are we going to know who's vaccinated or not? Are we more or less on the honor system as we think about going out without a mask?
Well, I think that's a very good question. And in terms of how it is we work through infection control in businesses, the public health enterprise works closely with OSHA. And, you know, we each have our swim lane, so to speak, or our jurisdictional oversight areas. But we work together. So in the next couple days, the state health department, along with the locals, as well as OSHA, will be working through how this will happen. I have a general sense that one of the opportunities will involve your proof of vaccination through a vaccination card that typically is given to people at various vaccine events, either their doctor's office or one of the county mass vax events. And that will be one of the ways to prove that you have been vaccinated. We have other systems, of course, but they're kind of clunky, right? So we have a state immunization registry that we all use to make sure that pharmacies and clinics and hospitals and the health department, et cetera, all put the vaccinations inside of that system. But it's pretty clunky for a business to access that system, and then they might have access to other records that would not be one of their patrons. So I doubt we're going to go that route. So we're going to see. I wish I had a better answer for you, Jason, but we're not there yet.
It seems like the CDC got a lot of its confidence to have this updated guidance released based upon the effectiveness of the vaccine. Can you talk a bit about if that's the case and if we have new evidence about how effective the vaccine is?
Gosh, you know, I think you're absolutely right in that space. And for some months, we have been really wondering how good are the vaccines that are available. We have systems to look at side effects, as we saw with, you know, the potential blood clot issues with the AstraZeneca vaccine and the Johnson & Johnson vaccine. And those systems have been well practiced for medications, vaccines, medical devices, literally for decades. But it takes quite a different system to assess effectiveness. You have to draw the blood of people and check their antibodies, and you have to do an assessment of their clinical infections, et cetera. So that's a bit more difficult. And I have to remind listeners that early on, when these vaccines were approved, they were approved as preventing COVID disease, which meant symptomatic COVID infections. And that's very different than preventing COVID infections themselves, which may be asymptomatic. We now have multiple studies. They began coming out already in January, but multiple studies showing how good these vaccines are at preventing COVID infection, not just COVID disease. Recently, there was one done in the healthcare space, looking at healthcare personnel, first responders. About 4,000 people were tested for weeks in that study, and they were all fully vaccinated, and they were assessed how many became infected during that time. And that study showed 90% effectiveness of these vaccines at preventing infection, not just preventing symptoms, right, symptomatic infection, but preventing infection, period, because they were tested with these PCR tests and the tests were negative. Then we've had countries present this data, most recently the country of Qatar, over 300,000 people showing a similar efficacy at preventing infection. Israel has done the same, other countries. So the collection of all of that data in multiple different venues across different populations is really heartening, really encouraging that these vaccines are markedly better, at least than our worst fears, at preventing infection. So once you can say that, once you can say you can prevent infection, well, you do need to take your foot off the brake a little bit. So I think that's the biggest driver. But I'm sorry to speak a little more. There's one other issue as well. I think it's not just that these vaccines are effective, but our modeling has also shown that no matter which model we look at over the next 4 months or so, we're going to have big drops in infections. And that's whether we're looking at infections or hospitalizations or death. Each model is showing us that the numbers, the slope of those curves is going down. So it all fits together, Jason.
Dr. Luedtke, do you imagine that this announcement might motivate people who've been on the fence about taking the vaccine or are flat out anti-vaccine into maybe changing their mind and thinking, you know, maybe I ought to think about getting this?
Well, I'm going to buff my crystal ball and, you know, take a deep look into it. I think that some people will be motivated by it. Some people will say, gosh, now we really have data showing not only that these vaccines are really quite effective and not only prevent hospitalization and severe disease, but prevent infection. But we also have a pretty significant benefit. If we're fully vaccinated, then we can go without masking and worrying about all these physical distancing recommendations. So I think some people will be heartened. I think some others, though, will probably say, well, what's the use? Most of the society is going to be walking around without masks because, you know, we're around 60% of people 16 and above in this county who are vaccinated now with at least one dose. So they'll probably be a little bit demotivated. But I think there'll be more people motivated to get vaccinated than demotivated.
I wonder, do you have any thoughts or concerns from your perspective that this policy might encourage people to, like you say, go out without mask, and that it might introduce risk for people who can't, for whatever reason, get the vaccine because maybe they have medical reasons or their children, for example? Is there any chance that this puts more risk into those groups?
You know, Jason, I think it's a really good point. And what I need to stress is this is not your get out of jail free card and you're free to go about and do anything you want. There still are sites where the recommendations will not change, such as in healthcare facilities. After all, in healthcare facilities, there are people typically at very high risk. They may be on chemotherapy. They may have an organ inside of them from someone else, and they're taking anti-rejection drugs, and their immune system is not working, or they may be showing up to be evaluated for COVID, and they may indeed be infected. So we really need to be protective in spaces like healthcare, like congregate settings, skilled nursing facilities, etc. So that will not change. The other areas, though, where we're going to be, you know, liberalizing the recommendations, I do think that there will be a lot of benefit to business. There'll be a great deal of benefit to promotion of other activities that would not have been able to take place in a meaningful way given the restrictions or the infection control requirements. But I think it's going to be a challenge. And in the next few days, and we have to do it quickly, we have to get out very clear guidance of where we need to maintain the restrictions and the recommendations for infection control and where people can really return to some sense of normalcy. And again, we're not there yet. Hopefully, maybe by Monday or Tuesday, certainly by next week's radio show, we will be there with better information.
So perhaps it's worth a reminder, and Dr. Luedtke, you can either back me up or correct me on this, but a person shouldn't consider themselves fully vaccinated until a full 2 weeks after their final dose of whichever vaccine they received, correct?
That is exactly right. Whether it's a two-dose vaccine, you need to be 2 weeks after the second dose, or if it's a one-dose vaccine, 2 weeks after that dose.
So we've talked a lot on this program about how social distancing and mask usage seems to have really tempered other respiratory diseases. What lessons from this pandemic and, you know, now with that it's been demonstrated that, you know, you can set an end date, so to speak, on mask guidance. What lessons from this pandemic might organizations like Lane County Public Health apply to mask guidance for navigating flu seasons going forward, for example?
You know, this I think is really one area of good news, and maybe this comes from being in the public health space for 30 plus years, but It's just fascinating to me how we've been saying for years and years, or you know, maybe your mother has been saying for years and years, cover your cough, cover your sneeze, etc., because it prevents spreading germs. And this pandemic has absolutely shown it again. When I talk to colleagues at work, when I talk to my family members, when I talk to some of my friends out there, I cannot think of a single person that has had a cold in the last 12 months who was an adult. Now, there's some kids out there who, you know, they've been playing, you know, as kids do, and they've been exposed, they had a cold. I don't know any adult who's had a cold, which, of course, I'm not talking to all 390,000 Lane County residents, but this has made a huge, huge difference in respiratory conditions, including influenza, including cold viruses, including the spread of other respiratory conditions. And that should clearly show people that, you know, mom was right. Cover your cough and sneeze. It really does make a difference. So I think that this is really, in many ways, confirming what we've already known in terms of infection control and respiratory infection control. But maybe some people will realize that, yeah, this can make a difference in other years, even outside of a pandemic. And some people will adopt masking, you know, every fall and winter during cold and flu season. I think we'll see that. Do they have to? No, but some people will. And hopefully some people who are at higher risk maybe will say, hey, here's an opportunity for me to be healthier. And maybe they will adopt that as well.
Maybe when it's time to put the snow tires on your vehicle, it's also time to make sure you've got masks for the season.
There you go. You routinize it, as they say. You make it your routine.
So this week, we've also learned that youth 12 and up are now cleared to receive the vaccine in Oregon and Washington, and there's supply available for them. A lot of people are taking this as encouraging news for sure. And I just wondered, are you seeing any questions come across Lane County Public Health about people with specific questions or concerns about this age group and the vaccine?
Well, you know, one of the areas we're having some questions is from parents or guardians who really want to make sure that this is in the best interest. And they want to talk to the providers, the nurses that they trust. So we in public health are really encouraging clinics, urgent cares, et cetera, to step up into that space where they've always stepped up, whether, you know, a parent or a guardian is asked about the measles vaccine or the yearly flu vaccine or, you know, some other vaccine that kids get. And this is the time to enter that space. And they've done it well for so many years. I don't think we need to preach and we don't need to tell them how to do it. But the questions that we're receiving are, okay, what happens with this vaccine and other vaccines? And several months ago, as we were preparing for the approval of the vaccine in the age 12 plus category, we realized that we didn't have enough data to say you can co-administer vaccines, which we do a lot, right? A child comes in for their well child check, and they need their diphtheria, tetanus, pertussis, and they need their measles, mumps, rubella, and they need their whooping cough, etc. And that happens because we've studied that you can do co-administration, and doing it at the same time, you still produce protective antibodies. Well, we didn't have enough time in this pandemic to do that, so the recommendation has been no vaccines within 14 days of any COVID vaccine, and that was our recommendation for all adults, too. And as we were preparing for adolescents, we thought, oh, gosh, adolescents get quite a few boosters. You know, they get the whooping cough booster, the tetanus booster in this age group, and they get the meningitis vaccine series in this age group. But now enough data has been gathered. I have not seen that data, but the CDC and the FDA have. And the recommendation this week changed. So another big change this week, Jason, is that you can do co-administration with these vaccines for adolescents. So that's a really good thing. And I have to say, it makes it so much easier than tracking, okay, you got the vaccine, let's just say tomorrow on May 15th. Have you had any vaccines from May 1st on? So you have to go back 14 days. And you can't have any vaccines for two more weeks through May 29th. Well, now we have enough data to say you can go ahead and do co-administration. If you happen to have received a vaccine today, you can go ahead and get a COVID vaccine tomorrow. So that's really, really encouraging.
You're listening to The Friday Show on KLCC. Lane County Public Health's Dr. Patrick Ludke is here, and we're ready to turn to some of your questions. Dr. Ludke, we got a question from Melissa by email who asks, can 11-year-olds who are almost 12 get vaccinated? My 11-year-old is anxious to receive the vaccine and to be safe this summer, but turns 12 in August when most of the summer is gone. Will her body change so much between now and August that it would make the wait necessary?
Well, unfortunately, rules are rules, and not only is the rule important, but the rule is backed up by what has been studied. And the study included persons age 12 and above, and we don't have data in the younger age groups yet. We know, for example, that Pfizer plans to submit their data for age 2 and above in September, so it won't be too much longer. I think that that will only be a few weeks after this particular child turns 12, so he or she will be able to make it in September. But it's really important that we focus on what we have data on. And, you know, as a parent, especially of several kids, you sit back and say, you know, gosh, my child who is 12 years old now is really mature and is physically or emotionally more like an 18-year-old, and yet my other child was the other way around, right? Took longer to mature. And that's absolutely true. I mean, parents have seen that. But you have to draw the line somewhere, and if it's been unstudied in those younger age groups, you just have to be careful. So I would suggest, I would say absolutely, you have to wait until the child turns 12.
We also heard from Kate, who has some questions about the effects of the vaccine on young girls specifically. Kate's email reads, I read the news report that hundreds of women have reported changes in their periods after being vaccinated, especially experiencing very heavy periods. I have also heard that there may be a hormonal component involved in the strokes associated with the Johnson & Johnson vaccine. I know that it is only the Pfizer vaccine that is authorized for 12 to 15-year-olds, but I would really like to know more about possible hormonal effects from COVID or the COVID vaccines before vaccinating my 12-year-old daughter.
So, again, you know, I think this the listener group here has heard me say before that it's really important for us to be skeptical and critical of all the things that we put in our mouth or put, you know, on our skin, in our body, whether it's food or vaccines or drink, whatever it is. So I think that's a healthy behavior, and I really encourage to continue to do that for yourself and for your family. And in that regard, I do wonder sometimes how it is that we have these theories that come out that really don't have any scientific backing, and I guess it's just fear. So I remember, you know, the vaccines came out in mid-December, and literally within a week or two, we heard about they cause infertility. And it's just amazing to me that the definition of infertility is trying to get pregnant over the course of 12 months and not having success. And of course, then by definition, you can't have infertility until after 12 months. And yet, within a very few days of the first vaccines being used, there were conversations about infertility. So what I would say is be critical, ask questions, absolutely work with your provider, your daughter's provider, and ask those questions specifically of him or her. That provider knows your child better than I do, better than any of us do. And they can take a look at if there have been past issues with when her period started, has she had ever issues with heavy flow, et cetera, and can really help you work through that. Right now, we just don't have any data to show that. And in the clinical trials in this age group, the data did not show any of that either. So, yes, we'll continue with what we call post-marketing surveillance to make sure that we assess it, but we don't have any signals that show that it's going to be a concern. And if we did, we wouldn't approve them for age 12 to 15.
To your knowledge, are Moderna and Johnson & Johnson doing trials and research into vaccines for youth, and where are they at with that?
Yeah, Moderna, absolutely. They are going to go down to age 2 as well. I know a couple manufacturers have looked at 6 months and above. I suspect Moderna will be a month or two behind the Pfizer submission in September. So before the end of the year, we're likely going to have vaccine for, you know, younger age, elementary school age kids. The Johnson & Johnson, I'm not sure. I haven't seen recent data. Several months ago, they did say they were going to work on phase 3 trials for adolescents and kids, but I haven't seen any further update.
We'll turn now to this voicemail that we got about the vaccine and side effects.
This is Nancy in Eugene. I wanted to ask, you hear a lot about people saying if you have not feeling well after the vaccine, that it's a good sign that your immune system is working. And I wondered if this is true or a little bit of a myth. And if it is true, does it mean if you don't have and you feel well after the vaccine that your immune system is not working well or not necessarily? Thank you. I really like this show and hope you will continue it. Bye.
I appreciate those questions. There's a lot buried inside of there. You know, it's interesting. First of all, no human body is exactly the same. I mean, we have general components, of course, that are the same. We have blood vessels and organs, et cetera. But we all metabolize things a little bit differently. Our immune system acts a little bit differently. We all have different immune memory cells that have been triggered from prior infections, and they know what we've seen before. So keep that in mind. But what I would say in general is that any foreign compound that gets inside your body, whether it's a dirty, nasty sliver or it's contaminated food, your immune system recognizes it as foreign and it mounts a response. And depending upon the dose of what it is that you've ingested or the needle that you've gotten or the sliver that you've gotten, and depending upon the type of contaminant in there, your body responds in different ways. So some viruses, bacteria, parasites, your body doesn't do much for a long time. Others, your body knows that things can get bad quickly and responds very, very quickly. So we cannot say that people who have not much of a systemic response to the vaccine, they didn't get a fever, they didn't feel terrible for several hours, will not still make a lot of protective antibodies. It's just so variable from person to person. So it's interesting that we've had a couple doctors on this show that participated in the trials. One of them had a pretty significant reaction to one of the vaccines and in the trial and was convinced that he was in the arm of the vaccine trial that included vaccine, not placebo. Turned out that he wasn't. He ended up getting, you know, sugar water, so to speak, instead of the vaccine, and was very surprised because he had a pretty significant reaction. So you just cannot predict. But in general, if you do have significant reactions, the odds are a little bit better that you're in the vaccine arm, say, of a trial than not getting it. But we can't say if it's good, better, or worse.
So quickly, we don't have a lot of time left, but we did get a question about getting back into the workplace. And the question reads, is it legal in the state of Oregon for employers of private business to require all employees to have a COVID vaccination as a term of employment? I know that's a question of the law, but do you have any insight into that?
So in general, yes. There are a few carved out areas where you cannot do that, such as healthcare in some congregate settings, first responders. But other businesses, gyms and bars and restaurants, they can. And I'm not an attorney, but I suggest this person work with their legal counselor, whoever they retain as part of their business. But in general, yes, they can. And several have already. And you probably just heard this week the University of Oregon is planning to mandate it for its staff, which, of course, it's a business and they pay the staff salaries. So, yes, you can do that under certain circumstances.
Well, Dr. Luedtke, that wraps up another show. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you, Jason, and have a great weekend.
You do the same. We'll make this episode available to listen to again on our website, klcc.org. You can also find the Friday show on the NPR One app and the KLCC mobile app. We had production help this week from Rachel McDonald. I'm Jason Brown. Be safe, well, and enjoy your weekend. This is KLCC.